You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. These podcasts explore the future of food and nutrition, featuring the innovations and the big ideas and the visionaries from across the food industry who are going to change our world. We like to dig deep and question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and I'm a gastronaut. Today, we're asking the question, how can you build a brand when you're not allowed to advertise, you can't place your food in the best spots in shops, and when promotions are banned? If you're scratching your head, you're not alone, because that's the challenge facing a huge number of food producers who make HFSS products. That's products high in fat, salt, and sugar. By October, it's expected that new laws will be enforced, placing a whole raft of restrictions on the HFSS category. Things are going to be very different, and it looks as though the opportunity to influence any legislation has now passed. So, rather than crying into their hot chocolates, can brands get creative and make an advantage out of the new legislation? Well, we've brought together an incredible team to discuss exactly this. With me are Rob White, co-founder at Zeal Creative. Hello there, Rob.
Hello.
We've got Jeremy Stern, CEO of Promo Veritas. Hello, Jeremy.
Hello.
And Ben Greensmith, Lord Chocolonely III, aka Country Manager at Tony's Chocolonely. Hello there, Ben.
Hello.
So welcome to all of you. Now, we've already made one podcast which discussed the likely HFSS restrictions for retailers, but there's a whole different set of challenges for brands. So, Rob, before we really get stuck in, can you outline the main issues for brands and the challenges that are lying ahead?
The food industry is really competitive, and the key requirements that we as an industry talk about in order to be successful and mental availability and physical availability. So really what we're talking about is visibility and the ability for people to buy your product. When we talk about mental availability, we're talking really about whether or not your brand's recognisable to consumers. Does it have distinctive assets, the logo, the packaging, the advertising? Do people see it? Do they recognise it? And then when we talk about physical availability, that's about when people are shopping, is it easily available for them to buy? So Coke, for example, have a mission that they always want to be within arm's reach. If you want to buy a soft drink, ideally, wherever you go, you'll always be able to pick up a Coke. So whether that's supermarkets, convenience store, or online. And to be successful, really, you want to be visible and you want to be available. Now, if your brand falls within the HFSS legislation, that's going to have a significant impact on both of those. So firstly, when it comes to visibility, there's restrictions on advertising pre-9pm, so before 9pm at night, and online, which is going to make it a lot harder for brands to reach a wide audience and a lot more expensive. And then when it comes to availability, unless you're a frozen product, then one of the really effective tactics is to get secondary displays in store, so displays that are away from your typical fixture, front of store, end of aisle, and that with a typical product in HFSS that might deliver a level of impulse purchase, that can account for 20 or 30% of your sales.
Wow, that's a heck of a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's no longer going to be possible. So in a really competitive category, it's going to be more expensive to be visible. It's going to be more difficult for people to see and find you. And that's the challenge for brands, really. So how, in that environment, can you get people to be thinking about your brands and to be committing to make a purchase before they get into a store environment or before they're able to buy the product?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it changes the entire journey, doesn't it? That you have to plot how you're gonna hit people. So this is fascinating. Now, I mean, so Jeremy, I mean, the moment's passed really to influence this. We're expecting implementation of this to happen in October, I believe.
Yeah.
Now, but there are some exceptions, aren't there? What determines whether a product will be restricted or not?
The first thing is the size of the store. So if it's below a certain square footage, mainly a sort of corner shop, then there's an exemption there. The other aspect is if it's a specialist retailer of a product that is high fat and sugar, an example might be Hotel Chocolat, where their core business is the sale of chocolate, they will continue to be allowed to run point of sale and window displays in a way that regular supermarkets are banned.
And I presume that supermarkets can't just name themselves chocolate shops that also sell fruit and veg. Anymore,
that's right. So. It's about the percentage of the sales that are sold within that store.
Damn. Opportunity just lifted out of our hands. Okay, now we've got a lot of listeners of this podcast who are food producers. So with all that in mind, let's be positive. Ben, when this legislation sort of began to evolve, and it's been a sort of long, torturous process, really. I mean, in your position as a company that makes chocolate, were you just screaming out and putting your heads in your hands and going, no? Or were you kind of thinking, okay, this is something to deal with, let's cope with it?
Yeah, that's really interesting because we actually welcome it as a business, and I think if you look in the Netherlands as well, which is our home country, where we've been around for about 15 years and are the biggest chocolate brand over there, we're actually campaigning for a sugar tax. So we don't necessarily believe that this is a bad thing, but that's because we take a view that actually, you know, chocolate is bad for you, but it shouldn't be bad for everyone in the value chain. So for us, we are focusing on business as usual, really. We haven't actually changed our strategy. We don't rely too much on promotions. We've only been around in the UK for the last 3 years, so we only tend to promote about 2 to 3 times. So I think the things that brands and businesses can do, I mean, if you look at the makeup of our product, I think you have to score 4 to be exempt from the HFSS ruling. Something like our milk chocolate is 26, right? So we're we're never going to get there. And people buy chocolate because it tastes good, but it's bad for you. So in a way, we look at this and think, well, actually, if this just means that consumers and shoppers are having to make a slightly more conscious choice, then it will ultimately have an impact on the category. But that it's not necessarily a bad thing. And I think particularly for those brands and products that are maybe at the more premium end, I think we may see consumers and shoppers making more informed choices. That means they may be buying a bit less, but they may be spending a bit more on that category and those purchases. But we're not sat here we're not going to change anything that we do. But I do appreciate for that there's a number of products and brands that will be out there that will be kind of on the margins of those rulings, and actually that's an opportunity for them to look to come below those HFSS guidelines so they can continue to promote and drive trial and get people into the brand. But there is a short window of opportunity, I think, now where brands can adapt.
Yeah, I mean, nonetheless, you have a bottom line, you have employees. We'd like Lord Chocolonely the Third to continue with a job, and we'd hate the drop in sales to shift you to Lord Chocolonely the Fourth. So let's think positively. Rob, what would you like to add to this?
Yeah, I think it's a really good point that Ben makes about there will be brands that look within their portfolio and they try and reformulate, and they will be reformulating to avoid the legislation. But ultimately, when it comes to the category, so you're talking about confectionery, soft drinks, people will want to have those small indulgences. That isn't going to change. This is It's a government-driven piece of legislation rather than consumer-driven. And there's lots of examples of brands within the confectionery category that have created products that are significantly less sugar, and they've just not sold particularly well because that's not what people want. So I think when Ben talks about informed decisions, he's absolutely right. People will still want to purchase from the category within HFSS. It's just they're going to be thinking about it a little bit more and probably a little bit less on autopilot.
And so this, I presume, Jeremy, is where the opportunity lies, because with all restrictions, this will pretty much affect companies uniformly, and so it changes the landscape. So let's be positive now for companies who sell HFSS. What are your top tips? Do they need lateral thinking? Do you need to target customers differently? It sounds like it could be an exciting time as well.
Well, certainly this year should be exciting for brands that are brave enough to take it on the chin. We're advising all of our clients to fill your boots, to get out there, to run major marketing campaigns.
Oh, while you can.
While you can, absolutely. Yes, brand advertising is necessary in order to start to build that connection with the consumer. But we think that direct marketing and prize promotions now, this year, before the law comes in, will then give you a platform for direct marketing, for building up a database that you can use in future years when the law wouldn't permit mainstream advertising. But the new law does not stop you having a direct relationship via email or via post with consumers. It's mainly about distribution in supermarkets and in broadcast media. So if you've got no database now, by the end of the year, you've got a couple of million people on a database. That gives you a platform for you then to develop.
That's really interesting.
So it's a time to think outside the box. It's a time to try to connect directly with your consumers. And although most types of price promotions are going to be banned in October, prize promotions will be allowed to continue. On-pack offers will not be stopped by this. And maybe the promotion of those will be, but the actual offers won't be. So we think that clients should start to get into that activity now.
Okay, so, I mean, not wanting to dumb it down too much, Jeremy says, let's throw money at the problem.
For now. Throw money at the problem in order to obtain the details of your customers so you can continue the marketing in the future away from broadcast media.
Okay, so Rob, would you agree with this, that direct marketing, which has evolved a lot over the last couple of years, is going to be an important route for sales in the future?
It'll certainly be an important part of the mix, yeah. I suppose if you think about brands and how they, you know, back to the 2 points about how brands do well over the long term. One of those is about how you build up. We talk about memory structures, so how you build up recognizable assets, and that's something that is done over a long period of time. So whilst you will see lots of brands doing a lot of activity in 2022 because they have the opportunity to do that, but when you look at the longer term landscape, it's going to be how do you reformulate your marketing mix? How do you kind of develop a new set of tools that will help to maintain that level of communication? And that certainly in the medium term is going to favour bigger brands that have been around for longer. So suddenly you've got less space to communicate in store. So naturally, the retailers are going to dedicate that space to the bigger brands because bigger brands sell more products. It's going to make it really difficult for smaller brands, new products to be launched effectively. And then how you communicate to people as well. So as much as you can build, and absolutely, you'll see lots of brands building databases this year. You've got, you know, it's no surprise McDonald's have just developed a loyalty scheme. It's all about how they build first party data. That's great for people who buy you at the moment. But anyone who really understands how brands operate recognize that you've also, it's always like a leaky bucket, you've also got to get new people into the brand. That's how brands grow. Yeah. And so how do you communicate to people in new environments when you can't use some of the traditional tools, particularly online, which is very cost effective? There are other ways to do it. There are other tools that you can employ. Absolutely, looking at how you can get direct to consumer websites and how we can sell more directly. But there are other tools that will help you to communicate, whether that's outdoor advertising, radio advertising. There are lots of other ways to do it as well. So I think Jeremy's right, but it's almost that dual approach of we've got to talk to our existing consumers, but we also need to make sure we've got a way of communicating to new people in the future once these restrictions apply.
So Ben, now I'm fascinated by this area because direct to consumer, I think Chocolonely does really well. You've got a comprehensive website. You can create your own packaging for your bar on your website. All these kinds of things. I would imagine the connection to consumers is particularly vital to your business. Is it expensive? I mean, you know, to set up all of this, all of the structure within which a consumer can feel a connection, can effectively communicate or be part of your brand, does it pay off? And I'm not just trying to get to grips with your profit and loss. I'm trying to think of for other brands who are looking for this area. Is it cost effective or do you do it just because you like doing it?
No, it is cost effective, and I think we've seen a big shift over the last couple of years with the pandemic, where it's become even more important. And I think for us as a business, even pre any noises and murmurings on HFSS, this has been a big area of focus because of the direct relationship, because you don't have a retailer in the middle taking margins out that frees up more margin for you to reinvest back into your business in other areas. For all those reasons, I think having a direct to consumer offer, I would say, is vital, and I'd say it's increasingly vital. So it's worth the investment.
Is that about literally the number of sales because you've got somebody who will come back again and again? Or is it those specific extra bits that you do, like create your own packaging?
It's a bit of both. I think obviously it is a sales channel, but it gives you direct access to communicate your message, 100% as you would like it without any watering down. And I think therefore as a means of marketing and reach and engagement, it's massively important. So for all those reasons, not just sales, it's kind of like the perfect tool for communication.
Yeah, so those communication channels are really important. So, Jeremy, have you got any examples of people who've started to do things that you are impressed by? Are there some precedents that have been successful? I know people have only really just realised that this is going to absolutely be real, so we're relatively early days. But what are the things that you've seen that you've thought, okay, that's going to crack it?
Rob and I actually share a client, Kellogg's. And I think that they have taken a long-term view about this a few years ago. So they've started on the journey of reformulation, trying to reduce sugar, introduce new variants with a range of success. They've also invested heavily in database marketing. So they've been running on-pack offers, but increasingly a lot of them are gathering information. And that then is helping to drive through agencies like Rob's the future strategies. So are they moving away from being fully dependent on broadcast medium? Probably not. Certainly it's another arm for them to focus on. Other companies like Cadbury haven't yet really grasped the full direct marketing, but are starting to do so only this year in the way that I suggested, filling your boots. They're investing much more now in their data.
Yeah. Hi there, only me. I just want to break into the conversation to say that if you're enjoying this episode, then once it's finished, you might want to check out another one called The Road to Net Zero: How Can the Food Industry Reach It? It looks at how the sector can aim to be carbon neutral by 2050 and the challenges that lie ahead. You can find it on our website at foodmatterslive.com. Now, back to the chat. Rob, is there going to be a knock-on effect in terms of the cost of these different marketing tools, i.e. marketing on social media, promotions on Instagram, Facebook and things like that? Is there going to be because of the shift in money from broadcast media to some extent, is this going to make other areas more difficult or are just going to be more opportunities?
The short answer is yes, it will make it more expensive and more difficult to communicate because of the fact there's more restrictions. So whether that's in-store, and if brands are paying for in-store space, then that's going to become highly competitive, or whether or not it's through different kind of marketing channels out the store environment. There are lots of other ways to communicate to people, though. So it will be no surprise to you to see lots of outdoor advertising, billboards, posters, digital screens. Lots of brands are going to be doing that over the next year because that's still available. Mm. Radio, where if you think about, Sonic signatures, which do really well, particularly with younger consumers, radio is great because it can get you significant reach and can be really, really cost effective. So there are other channels that brands will probably start to use a lot more as you see that over the next kind of 12 to 24 months. I think it's very difficult to predict exactly what's going to happen because there hasn't been a piece of legislation really like this within the food industry. I know people talk a lot about cigarettes and e-cigarettes and the journey that they went on, but this is quite different because the brands are still going to be communicating in different environments. What you'll probably also see is lots of test and learn, lots of brands trying different things. You look at models like Red Bull, for example. They've done a great job of kind of building visibility for the brand outside any type of store environment by the experiences that they create. And if I was a smaller brand, I would be looking to some of the bigger brands to see what they're doing. And, Coke's a great example. They do things really well, so you won't go far wrong just to follow them and see what they do over the next 24 months and some of the tactics that they employ as well.
Yeah. And Ben, I mean, I would say that Chocolate Only is very good at counterintuitive marketing. As you say, you don't want to eat people to eat more chocolate. It's very much about how the chocolate is made and the process and buying into that. Now, you could say that you're different from other companies, but everyone needs their angle, don't they? And everyone needs to be counterintuitive in their own way. Is this going to be a bonanza for innovative marketing, do you think?
I think the bonkers ideas,
you know, the Red Bull ideas, the chocolate only ideas.
Yeah, I think it will definitely force the marketing teams to be more creative and look at those opportunities that can gain traction and get picked up and talked about for, you know, hopefully for all the right reasons. So I think it definitely is going to force a rethink in terms of plans and strategies and how businesses approach, communication to consumers. So, and I think actually, if you think, I mean, the changes are they're going to have a bigger impact on the bigger businesses because they tend to be the businesses that have the big budgets to spend on media and also are getting the big visibility and off-shelf displays in store in the larger stores. So whilst I think it's going to be a much tougher fixture because the fixture is going to be smaller, you're not going to have that off-shelf display. I think the opportunities for some of those smaller challenger brands to really understand, well, what is their role? What's the differentiation that they offer within the category is going to give them an opportunity to really engage with the retailers to get more standout on the fixture that does remain. But yeah, definitely it's going to force a lot more creativity.
Yeah. So, Jeremy, is it incumbent on companies to stop their usual ways of thinking, to get outside the box, and to start dealing with the uncomfortable stuff, the bonkers ideas that that a lot of companies are uncomfortable with, but almost need to happen?
Absolutely. It's almost to the day 200 years ago since a guy called William Webb Ellis, playing a game of football, decided, I don't want to kick a ball. I want to pick it up and run with it. And the fundamentals of the game are not that dissimilar to soccer, but that was an out-of-box experience and it's still being played worldwide or whatever. And I think we're facing that sort of change where the rules are going to be different. They're going to be linked. They won't be completely thrown away, but they will have to be adapted in a significant way. And yes, experiential marketing, forms of sponsorship, outdoor, the things that lazy marketeers perhaps have not done, because it's so easy to make one phone call to your agency and spend a £4 million budget on a TV campaign, all right? And you don't have to do an awful lot of work. Sorry, Rob. But once you start getting into these more esoteric areas, the ones that are now going to be allowed, that requires a lot more thought, more strategy and execution.
Yeah. So, Rob, are these companies able to do these things? You know, it's a common refrain, isn't it? Companies are set in their ways. We're constantly trying to get people to be more imaginative. Is this a door that you just continually beat upon?
I think the general consensus is that they're going to need to be more creative. The challenge that you've got is that large organisations are by their very nature risk averse. Yeah. And therefore, when you're developing a campaign, you will go through various rounds of, sense checking that you're going to deliver a really strong return on investment for them. And the difficulty is that the more out of the box, the more creative, the more unusual your activity, then the less likely it is that you can exactly predict how it's going to perform. So I think that by its very nature gives an advantage to smaller, more agile companies who can take a chance, who are a bit more prepared to do that and don't necessarily have the really big budgets of the bigger brands. But there's no guarantee of success there. So I think that's a real challenge.
I think the other aspect is that non-food manufacturers and makers of HFSS compliant are going to have a field day. Because in supermarkets, all those gondola ends, all that promotional display, which has been vacated by the chocolates and the crisps and the sweet drinks, will have to be used by the retailers.
Yeah.
And I know that the big boys are trying to come to terms with how they're going to work next year because their usual arrangements for Easter eggs is going to be a little bit different.
Any suspicions about who's going to take the place of the HFSS products by the checkouts?
Well, one thought from one retailer we spoke to was alcohol.
Oh, lordy, yeah.
because you really don't want it to be household goods, your fairies and washing up liquids or whatever. The margins are not the same as they are on food. Mm. Whereas on alcohol, they can be quite good, and the volumes can be good. So the irony is, trying to get us to eat healthy may have a downside on us drinking a bit more.
Oh my God, Rob, do you think that's going to be the case?
I think it's going to be really interesting to see how the retailers respond, because they've got kind of two opposing forces, really. They've got the shareholders and a general sentiment that they want to ensure that people's baskets become more healthy, they're less HFSS products, and obviously help to address some of the challenges that we've got with obesity. And on the other hand, anyone who deals with retailers knows that there's also a real challenge around sales and profit. And you know, there's a reason why big brands get on gondola ends and secondary displays, because they have to pay a significant contribution in order to secure that. So I think there's a tension there, and I'd be really interested to see how each of the different retailers respond to it, whether or not they reformat the stores and change some of the layouts, whether or not they develop some new kind of permanent fixtures in store that allow brands to get secondary displays within those. I don't know. It's going to be really interesting to see how they respond.
I mean, yeah, I guess you could change the chocolate area. And as Ben was saying, you know, it's a luxury product. You know, everyone knows that it's a treat. How about it being sort of some luxurious emporium? Dim the lights, get some velvet flooring around. And this is the area. I mean, the potential for change is actually quite significant. Okay, let's stick with the program here. Now, Ben, there's a slight tangent here. We talked a little bit earlier on about radio. Now, a lot of these brands are very visual brands, but we know that these restrictions won't be applying to digital audio. Well, let's find out in October, but we think so. Now, audio is a booming industry, music streaming, podcasts like this one, loads of digital radio. Is this a huge area of opportunity? Is it something that you've been looking at and in terms of changing the way that you market?
It's not something we've looked at. But that is because we don't traditionally spend on above the line media. So we rely very much on a pull strategy rather than a push strategy. So we're not your typical brand in terms of how and where we spend. But obviously it is an exemption, but I'm probably not the man to ask about that.
Okay, Jeremy, as an area of opportunity, how do you see digital audio?
Absolutely, I think radio will. It's already having a good time at the moment, people being more in than out. Drive time shows have been affected, but daytime shows have actually seen some increases. And I think, yes, that major brands will go. I think the challenge for radio is how it sells itself. It's hugely fragmented now because of so many digital stations. And that can be quite a challenge for brands and their agencies trying to sort out a campaign. But if the radio industry gets its act together a little bit more, Radio Center is I think the focal point, and they can sell up packages, then I think radio will do well in 2023.
Yeah. Is there any way of connecting a radio ad to any usable statistics in terms of uplift in sales? Or is it still that just throwing it out there and hoping for the best? Rob, any thoughts on this?
No, absolutely. You can link it. So we work with there are organisations like IRI and Nielsen who analyse sales data. So whenever we run a campaign, what we'll do is we'll kind of put in test and control stores to identify what the impact is of any particular campaign. Mm-hmm. So we can say in a certain region where we've run radio and we've done some additional media, what's the impact of that versus doing no radio at all? So you can get pretty accurate in terms of understanding the impact of it. And radio is really quite cost effective to give you national reach. It's brilliant as a medium. So it's great because it's getting people thinking differently about brands. You've got to be creative in terms of the way you do it.
Absolutely.
And again, back to a point I made earlier around sonic signatures. You know, you think about the whistle at the end of the McDonald's advert. That is something that's very powerful and becomes highly recognisable. So certainly for bigger brands that want to look at alternative routes to communicate, then it can be really, really effective. And then just from a food point of view, if you've got people who are driving to a supermarket, then there is obviously the chance that you might be able to get them before they get into the in-store environment to start the shopping. So Yeah, really, really effective and worth considering, regardless of the size of brand, really. I suppose it's about how do you then connect it with the other visual pieces of advertising that you're doing, and can you make that link? Because again, it's back to that point about memory structures, that continual reminder of this is our brand and this is what our brand is all about, so that at the point at which someone's making a purchase decision, they're thinking about your brand.
Yeah, absolutely. Ben, have you got is there a Chocolonely jingle? Can you sing Chocolonely for me?
No, it's a sure answer.
Chocolonely. No, we can make it up here and now. Okay, Ben, we need to start closing this off, really. But do you think that these new rules? I know that you consider yourself slightly different from most brands, but I think every brand probably thinks that about each other, don't they? So, do you think that these new rules will have an impact on the diet of the Great British public? And I'm not speaking specifically about Chocolonely, but you know this shift. I'm not complaining about these rules. I think they probably had to happen. But do you think they're going to have a significant effect?
Yes, I do. And I think that's the very, very reason that they've been introduced. And, you know, thinking about the impact, I think probably in our category, 15 to 20% drop in volume, which is pretty significant. And then if retailers are making it easier for shoppers to switch their habits into something, you know, deemed more healthy, then I think that will definitely happen. I think there are definitely things that brands and businesses can do to plan for that. And I think focusing on things, that one thing we haven't talked about, not just obviously media and communication, is the physical availability and thinking about your channel strategy ahead of that time as well, because it is impacting, you know, the bigger stores. But actually in some of those smaller stores, as we spoke about earlier, there's still going to be opportunities to display.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Jeremy, you mentioned reformulation. It's a very different area to Ben's, where he's firmly, he ain't getting out of the HFSS category. But do you think the reformulation that is going on will have a tangible effect on nutrition in the UK?
No. Probably not in the food area, not until the quality of sugar substitutes increases. There are a number available, but they do unfortunately affect the consistency and the taste and the texture of products generally. I think the area where it has made a difference is in drinks, where now Pepsi Max is becoming the dominant force in the Pepsi stable, and Coke Zero is now the red can with only a small amount of black at the top. And they've reprioritized their marketing effectively around the Zero one. But that's also because there's a price difference, because there's a sugar tax on soft drinks. So one is maybe 10p more expensive than the Zero one.
Okay, so Rob, there's only a short amount of time left. There's work to be done for lots of companies. But what are the mistakes to avoid? Presumably, as Jeremy says, doing nothing would be the first mistake. But what should companies not be doing that possibly you've seen them wanting to do?
I don't think that companies should be trying to avoid the restrictions. So I think what you'll probably see is certainly the more reputable companies are about will behave within, not only within the legislation, but also within the spirit of the legislation, which is quite important.
Yes.
And that I wouldn't, you know, if we were working with a brand and they said, we want to do everything we can to avoid this and to try and get around it, then I don't think that's the right way to behave. And in the long term, that's not going to be received positively either by the government, retailers, or even by consumers, really. So it's about how you can behave within the spirit of the legislation. The other thing I would avoid is doing nothing, I think, as Jeremy and Ben have both alluded to. It's in a way, it's the biggest piece of legislation within the food industry for a significant period of time. And there's only a few markets, such as, I think, Korea, who've had similar changes in legislation. So it'd be really interesting to see how people change. The one thing we've seen over the course of the pandemic is that, you know, people can change the behaviour and the habits. It takes a long time for that to happen. So I don't think this is going to be a quick fix for the government. But it'd be really interesting to see how people's shopping habits start to evolve over the next kind of 12 to 36 months.
Yeah. Okay. And Ben, I mean, you're pretty stark figures that you gave us. Did you say, I think, 15-20% sort of decrease in the entire market?
Yeah, that's I mean, that's what I've seen from some numbers from IRI.
Now, for a lot of companies, that will be disastrous. Do you think that companies in your sector should actually think about downsizing?
I think it's too soon for that. I think it will definitely have an impact on businesses, P&Ls. Look, not necessarily in a bad way. If certain buckets of spend have been cut, then and promotions have been cut, then that might free up a bit more gross margin for those businesses to reinvest into other areas. But I honestly think at this stage, you know, there's considerations. People are going to be looking at, you know, the size of their teams. But I think it's still too early to say. I think there's a number of things that companies and businesses can do just to get a little bit closer to the retailers, to get closer to their channel strategies, to really understand what makes their brand different and how they're differentiated from some of the big players as well, and also understand, you know, what is the reason and where can they double down on those points of difference to really carve out a bit of a niche on that fixture. Because I think as promotions and feature and media changes, I think people will be spending probably a little bit more time at the fixture, and the opportunity to and the need to really carve out a niche and a reason to be on those fixtures in the first place is going to become even more important. And I think there's a period of time now where you can really start to understand your brand and your business and your consumer as well.
Yeah. Okay. Rob, is there something you want to add to that?
Yeah. Just really picking up on Ben's point, people, when they shop, generally shop on autopilot, and shopping on autopilot, they generally pick up the, you know, from a repertoire of the biggest brands that they know and recognize. So I think Ben's right. It's about how can brands get people to think differently about their products. It's a double hit this year and next year for a lot of big companies. So you've got massive inflationary costs combined with this challenge in terms of how you get to market to people. So I think what it will lead to is companies focusing on effectiveness and identifying what they do that's effective and doing more of that. So I don't think it's a concern for well-run companies, but it will really kind of make sure they're sharpening the pencils in terms of understanding how they can have effective marketing campaigns.
Fantastic. Okay, last question then is to Jeremy. If you're a food manufacturer and you want more advice on this, if you've got a brand and you're worried about what the heck's going to happen over the next 12 months, where should you go? What should you do?
Well, the first thing is come and talk to our team. I mean, we have our own in-house legal team, and we're advising clients and making sure that they stick to the straight and narrow. But in addition to that, the Department of Health does have some useful guidelines. They will be continuing to publish and update them as we get to know more about the law, because the laws that we've outlined are not yet set in stone. There may be some variations, and it's still got to pass through both chambers of it. But I would talk to your agencies. They should have some knowledge, although we're finding not that many do. But it is reach out and break the box.
Okay. Well, Jeremy Stern, Rob White and Ben Greensmith, you've all been wonderfully eloquent, and thank you so much for sharing your knowledge. I think quite a few surprises in there for me as well, so I really appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed that episode. If you did, there are plenty more like it. Now, before I go, just want to tell you about a Food Matters Live masterclass that's coming very soon, focusing on this very subject, HFSS legislation. We don't have a date yet, but if you'd like to register your interest, jot down this email address, info@foodmatterslive.com. Send an email with the subject line HFSS Legislation Masterclass and ask to be added to our mailing list. Follow to get every episode of Table Talk freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.